when leadership changes the discourse, when they change what is being offered to the people react very quickly. So what we see in terms of militarism, in terms of the perpetual war, and what we, the atrocities that we are doing in the West Bank and in Gaza and everywhere in the region, that is a language. That is the language that the Israeli government is speaking, and they are they know only that language. So that's why we need a change in government that speaks different languages and teach the people.
All right, new episode of Young and Naive. I have a new guest. Who are you?
My name is Yonatan Zeigen. Currently, I live in Tel Aviv, in the neighborhood of Florentine, where we are sitting right now. Originally, I'm from Kibbutz Be'eri, in the Gaza envelope, as we call it. I have three kids and a partner.
But you're also a politician now?
I'm running for parliament. I think there's a difference.
You want to be a politician.
I want to impact my reality. And I think that civil society is crucial and it's needed, but also top to bottom is we have to do it.
Top to bottom?
From government downwards. Because what I have done since October 7th is work on the ground. In civil society, in organizations. I'm on the board of the Parent Circle Families Forum. I joined after October 7th. Go to the streets, go to protective presence in the West Bank, do things like that. I think it is very important and it's very needed, but it has a glass ceiling because we need a policy change, a lawmaking that will be radically different than what we have today.
Give us some examples. Like, what kind of policy change are you seeking?
Well, it's on all levels. It's one is ending the occupation and pursuing a peace with the Palestinians. Another thing is equality in Israel proper between Jews and Arabs. It's not just a societal thing. It's not just racism between people. It's also laws that prevent Arabs from mobility, that prevent them rights in real estate and in education and in welfare, in all aspects of life. It's also the economy in general. We have a capitalistic approach from the government that we have to change. We have to raise the minimum wage. We have to bring back ownership to the state of services like welfare. We have to invest in infrastructure. So on all levels, social justice, equality, ending the occupation and resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we need radical change in government, not only in the streets.
It sounds like a big undertaking.
Yes.
Are there other parties, other politicians that want this? Why do you need to run? Why do you guys founded a new party?
Well, there are aspects of what I was saying fragmented in different parties. There is no political movement or project that is holistic in the way that I presented now.
Why? Yeah.
You have to ask those politicians.
I mean, I heard there's like a Labor Party.
There is now running a party that is called the Democrats. Mm-hmm. It's remnants of the Labor Party and a party that was named Meretz. They joined together now. Yeah. They are running. I don't feel that they offer a completely new vision to Israel, Palestine, and the region. I feel like they are a lot better than the current government,
sure.
No doubt about it. but they want to go back to October 6th, and I want to create a new reality. And they are a Jewish Zionist party. So they have Arab guests. They have like an Arabic representative. We are a joint Arab-Jewish party to the core. So there are differences that we may belong to the same camp in terms of opposition to the current government and the ability to fantasize about a different reality, but we don't share the same values in terms of the whole three: peace, social justice and equality.
Hey Leute, der heutige Supporter dieser Sendung ist ihr alle. Und ihr alle seid die beste Unterstützung für unabhängigen, kommerzfreien Politikjournalismus auf dem Publikumsmarkt. Und darum bin ich ein Fan davon. Also ein Fan von euch. Macht weiter so. Per PayPal oder Überweisung. Danke dafür und jetzt geht's weiter.
It kind of sounds like a fantasy to go back to October 6th.
When you talk
about the other parties?
That's the way I look at it, yeah, but people, they will tell you that I'm fantasizing, right? Because I'm utopian, because I talk about...
You're naive.
Naive. We talk about things that the people are not ready for. And I always feel, who's the people? I'm the people.
Exactly.
We are all the people. And if I think what I think, then there is a percentage of the people who think the way I think. And we need, it's a dialectical process. We need to build societal power. We need to build political power in order to make this fantasy into reality.
How did your life change between October 6th and 7th?
It changed dramatically in the way I lead my life. It didn't change my convictions. It didn't change the way I analyze reality. But it completely changed my day-to-day. Before then, I'll start earlier. Yeah. In my teenage years, I grew up in a very politically aware home. My mother, Vivian Silver, she was a very dominant a peace activist.
In Israel.
In Israel, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was... the way that I thought that would be my path in life as well. And I even went to study law in order to become like a human rights lawyer. I remember making that decision after being active in the West Bank with different organizations, Combatants for Peace, Rabbis for Human Rights, and standing in Sheikh Jarrah, which is a East Jerusalem neighborhood that is already back then, but all the time is going through this Jewifying process of taking the homes of the Palestinians and giving it to Jews. We would demonstrate, and I stood there and I felt, this is good, but we need more impact. So I went to study law, and then something happened to me. I grew up in the 90s. The 90s brought us Oslo. You remember Oslo? You know what I'm talking about?
I heard about it. the so-called peace
right.
process.
So today, I have a lot of criticism about Oslo, but back then, it was really an energy of change. Mm-hmm. And that we are close. And that peace is possible. That changed, that eroded gradually until 2000, when Barak came back and said there is no Palestinian partner, second intifada broke, and then the narrative changed from we are a peace-seeking people that have to defend ourselves, but peace is possible, to the conflict is our fate, and we will manage the conflict. We won't solve it, we will manage it.
Because we can.
Because we can. And I went to study. There were a lot of violent clashes in Gaza, 2008, 9, 12, 14.
Did you serve in the IDF?
No, I refused to serve.
It's rare, right?
It's rare, yes. I mean, it's mandatory, and you can be put in jail if you don't do it.
You didn't go to jail?
Nope, they didn't put me in jail. But the, also the peer pressure mm-hmm. is, I mean, the societal pressure is very, very heavy. I mean, I was shunned for a period of time in my own community.
For refusing?
For not going into the army. So it's not an easy decision. But it's a necessary decision in my mind.
You don't regret it?
No. No. But what I felt by 2014 was a sense of helplessness. Like, I can't do anything about it. It's too big. And my first child was born that year. And I fell into what I call my political coma. And shied away from engagement. I quit my job as a lawyer and I went and studied a master's in social work and just slipped into this fantasy, this shared fantasy of most Israelis that we can live our lives with the occupation. Okay, it's bad, it's terrible, but we're not paying any prices.
The others are.
The others are. So I'm ashamed of that, but that was my reality. I started focusing on something that I can nourish, my own family, instead of something that I felt I don't have any impact on. And that bubble burst for me on October 7th, when I sadly had to listen on the phone while my mother was violently killed during the massacre in Kibbutz Be'eri. And that was a completely new feeling of helplessness. But this time, it sparked a deep sense of responsibility in me. I realized that I have to be involved. I have to contribute whatever I can so that all of us, Israelis and Palestinians, stop paying these prices. Because October 7th, it didn't start history. It was an outcome. It was an outcome of a century-long conflict, 60 years of occupation, oppression. And it's not a question of justification, right? I don't justify any means of violence, not by the oppressor and not by the oppressed. I do justify resistance. I just prefer nonviolent resistance. I think it can be also more effective if it's done properly. But I do understand that violent resistance is a given in these settings. You can't run away from it. When you oppress someone, you will get resistance. So if we want to be safe, we need to create a political national reality that doesn't demand resistance. The only way to do that is by shifting the standpoint to equality, treating Palestinians as equals in their humanity to us. So that's what I've been doing since October 7th. I quit my job as a social worker and became dedicated to co-resistance, to reconciliation, to peace work, and now to politics.
Do you feel less helpless?
I do.
Because it's still the same situation. I mean, this is so big. No individual, no small party can change reality.
It's true, but maybe it's counterintuitive, but the more you are engaged, the more you feel like you have impact and control and ownership. Mm-hmm. Ownership on your own story, ownership on your society, a sense of belonging to a community that does the same thing, meeting and partnering with Palestinians and realizing that it's not the two sides of this conflict are not Israelis and Palestinians. It's Israelis and Palestinians that want mutuality, that want to solve the mutual problem of how two peoples share a land, and people who want exclusivity and to destroy the other and to dehumanize the other. These are the two sides of the conflict. So I have Palestinian partners that I belong to, that we belong to a peoplehood together, more so than the inherited affiliation groups.
What's the plan? Like, how can your side, you know, win out eventually? I mean, it's easy. It's easy to talk about, you know, we need to have equality and the occupation, be a democratic state, I guess, instead of a Jewish state, right?
Well, the concrete solution has to be decided together. Mm-hmm. I think that from what I am exposed to in the Jewish society and in the Palestinian society, I do think that the most a feasible thing is two states with a shared homeland, with
like a federation,
federal establishments. Mm-hmm. I think that after years of marginalization and oppression and dehumanization, I think that the Palestinians want first a step of self-determination and statehood. And it's natural because the world is divided into nation states. Mm-hmm. So
as long as there are nation states,
so yeah, that's the like the go-to. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's possible to create a Palestinian state alongside an Israeli state, but not a separatist, not a hard border between us, but shared establishments.
How do you convince many, many Israelis, because you need millions of Israelis, you know, to change their mind, right? I mean, most Israelis, based on, you know, polls and who they're voting for, they're against what you're saying. And you need to convince them at some point.
You can't
make them.
It's a tricky question. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they are against the essence of what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. When I meet an Israeli who is completely devoured by revenge and hatred and distrust, what does he want in the end? When you ask him, okay, what do you want? He wants safety. He wants security. He wants well-being.
Yes.
He thinks that the way to achieve that is by military power, right? But he is not being offered anything alternative. I think that if leadership offers an alternative, a concrete alternative, that then we can see a very dramatic and fast shift in public opinion. Because public opinion, it's elusive. You feel, when you look at it, you feel, okay, that's society, right? That's our fate. That's the zeitgeist, and we can't change that. But I don't know, like, how do Germans think about zeitgeist. It's a German word, but I think about it. It's in a very temporary fashion because it
can change quickly.
It can change quickly and transform into a new zeitgeist, right? That's the point of the term. How does it change? It changes both from the ground, as I said before, with rejuvenation of civil society, with a mobilization of people to protest, and it changes from leadership. And we see that all through history, in every country around the world. people have the capacity, nations have the capacity for atrocities. I don't have to tell you that. And they also have the capacity to build wonderful things. I also don't have to tell you that. And it changes. It can change quickly if you create new frameworks. And that's what we're trying to do in this party, a place for us all.
I was born in former East Germany, and it took only a few weeks for, you know, new zeitgeist in 89.
Right. How many years did it take for Israel as a country to forgive the Germans formally?
You tell me.
5 years. 6 years. We started getting compensation. We started diplomatic relations. And that was a harsh thing to to overcome.
Oh, yeah.
But we did it because how long did it take after the 73 war with Egypt, the most terrible of our enemies? How long did it take to sign a peace agreement?
8 years.
Yeah, and even less if you count the Sadat visit. When we are offered something as a people, when we are offered a different framework, a different mindset, we take it.
What role does, you know, the constant wars play? You know, recently Israel and America attacked Iran. You know, there's this war in Gaza, many consider a genocide. There's the occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. There are, you know, things going on in Syria and Yemen, the invasion of Lebanon. And Israel is mostly winning these things, if you, except for, you know, Iran. But like, what role does the military might of the Israeli military play? Because like, as long as, you know, Israel's winning, I can see the zeitgeist not change.
Ask Germany to stop funding us militarily and you'll see. I think
that's going to be easy.
I think that the international community plays a very crucial role in the enablement of our military campaigns. But societal, if we're talking about Israeli society, it's in the same paradigm. As I said, militarism is the only thing that is offered to us. So it's hard to have political imagination when you are so submerged in this paradigm of we are the world's scapegoats, everything is anti-Semitic, everything is existential, the Arabs have an inherent violence to them, and we will die if we don't attack, right? And then we attack. If we are offered diplomacy, when Trump did the 20-point Trump plan, you saw people in the streets that vote for Netanyahu talking about peace. Trump brought peace. Billboard signs in Ayalon, thank you, Trump, for bringing peace. So you can be cynical, right? It demands cynicism, right? But it is an example of when leadership changes the discourse, when they change what is being offered to the people react very quickly. So what we see in terms of militarism, in terms of the perpetual war and what the atrocities that we are doing in the West Bank and in Gaza and everywhere in the region, that is a language. That is the language that the Israeli government is speaking, and they are they know only that language. So that's why we need a change in government that speaks different languages teach the people.
What role does the, you know, Israeli media play? I mean, Israelis watch a lot of TV still, I heard, you know, newspapers and oligarchic structures in, you know, the media structure. What role does, you know, changing the media discourse play? Does the media, you know, cover your party? What do you guys want? Or are you on the fringe?
It depends. The Arab media is covering us a lot. The Jewish media is hesitant, like the voters.
I can imagine it's easier to get voted into the Knesset if you are constantly on TV or in the newspapers.
We saw that with Ben-Gvir years ago. It's true.
What can you learn from Ben-Gvir? No, that's a joke.
Oh, you know, we can. Populism that knows how to sweep people's energy and sentiment. That's important.
Yeah.
He has a skill. But also, as you said, the media plays a very important role in our society in what we know or don't know. There's a saying that you have countries like Russia or Iran that they sometimes pull the plug out of the media, and then people can't know what's going on in the world, in their own country. Our media pulled their own plug. It didn't come from the state actively. So people in Israel are not really aware, if they don't look for it actively, about what is going on in the West Bank and in Gaza.
Talk to Anna Saraguti yesterday. Yes. We talked about self-censorship and all this.
Yes, self-censorship and also incentives for, like, government incentives for Channel 14 and restrictions on other channels. Mm-hmm. So you have a really strong Channel 14, and then you say, that's what the people want. They get the rating. But we don't talk about the fact that they get incentives from the state. And what's the word? Like, they are not...
independent?
No, they are not...
Take your time.
Supervised. They are not supervised like the other channels. They can do whatever they want, and they present themselves as news, but they are not news. And other channels couldn't do that because it's against the law. But Channel 14, they do that. And they get exempt. They get impunity. So it's not just like it's a dance between state and people. The state can create a lot of streams in the public opinion, with policy, with lawmaking, with committees in the parliament, with allocations of budgets. And we see that. We see that in the media as well.
One question regarding the media. Like, I heard the group that it was, your party is a place for us all, but there's a group called Standing Together. You know, it's a Jewish-Palestinian peace group. And they invaded Big Brother, the reality show, a few years ago. And they wore, like, Get Out of Gaza shirts.
Yeah.
Were you part of it?
No, I wasn't.
You didn't go on Big Brother.
No. I wasn't a member, an active member of Standing Together. I collaborated with them in different activities, but Standing Together is a very based, well-based organization for 10 years already. And
they co-founded the party.
And prominent figures from Standing Together broke out and formed, and we formed this party, a place for us all. But Standing Together remains a separate entity, an organization that is still active.
So there have been other, like, let's call it Arab-Jewish parties before. I mean, there was Hadash, founded in 1977. There was Dam, which never made it into Knesset. Is it true, like with Hadash, it was mostly by Palestinian Israelis for Palestinian Israeli voters? And what's the difference to A Place for Us All?
Well, Hadash, the joint aspect of theirs is from a communist heritage. So in that sense, there is like a non-national peoplehood that invited Jews and Arabs together to form this political movement. But as a political party, they are a Palestinian party, an Arab party, that extends a hand that is open to Jewish solidarity.
Yes.
Very important. I always voted for Hadash. Most of the elections I voted for Hadash. We talk about Arab-Jewish partnership to the core, from the activists to the establishments of the party and to the representatives. So in Hadash there was always one Jewish representative. We are currently 3-3. Three Palestinian citizens of Israel, three Jewish Israelis. So there's a difference in that.
But why is it important?
The partnership aspect?
Yes. is it basically because you want equality for Israel and Palestinians, for everyone, that you want to show it with your party?
Yes.
Be the change you want to see?
Yes. Right. And I also think that the only way for us to solve our problems in Israel proper and between Israel and Palestine is through a joint endeavor. We feel, all of us feel the problems the same way, right? I don't mean structurally. Palestinians are oppressed. We belong to the oppressing side. But when we don't, in Israel, when we don't have a functioning bus, or we don't have a functioning educational system, if Palestinian citizens are not allowed to practice medicine because they studied abroad instead of here, then we have a shortage in doctors in Israel. So we all feel it the same. When we lose loved ones to the conflict, when I work together with a bereaved Palestinian mother or a son, the sentiment is the same. So if our problems are shared, our solutions have to be shared as well. And you can't do that with a one uninational party, either a Jewish one like the Democrats that is going to center right, or with Hadash that are categorically opposition. They can't join a coalition. They're not willing to join a coalition. And I respect that because the system is so corrupt. But I want, in our party, we want to change the system. Right? We don't want to sit in the current mechanism. We want a new mechanism. And in order to do that, you have to infiltrate it. You have to change it.
From within.
From within.
That sounds difficult.
It is difficult. It's a challenge that that we need to face.
How difficult is it to have a, you know, party based on equality? I mean, as you said, like, there are three Jewish leaders and Palestinian Israeli leaders. Is it easy to come together and you know, find policies and all this? But because I can imagine there's still like some kind of conflict, even maybe among, you know, Jews, Israelis or Palestinians. How do you come up with you know, a plan for the election, a plan for your party?
You know, I've been in this project for a few months now, and I haven't encountered friction. Wow. In that sense.
Like in Germany, whenever there are like party, you know, delegations, or they meet once a year, it takes days for them to come up with, you know, compromises. And so.
It's, you know, I talked about it before. When you shift away from your inherited affiliation group and you stop seeing yourself as, I'm a Jewish Israeli and I have to protect my privilege, and you move towards a joint peoplehood and you move towards a universalistic view of problem solving, then it doesn't matter if my partner is Palestinian. I acknowledge the power dynamic and then we aim to fix it together. So I don't feel I lose anything. I feel I only have something to gain from egalitarian points of view and the shared reality.
Like, just based on what you said earlier, because like in Germany, people have heard about, you know, apartheid in the West Bank, you know, racial segregation in West Bank. But when it comes to Israel proper, I think many Germans still think, okay, there's a democracy and based on the law, Palestinian Israelis and Israeli Jews are equal.
Well,
that's not true.
I invite them to be disillusioned. We can see it in a very tragic example with what is called Arab crime, right? Every day, a Palestinian citizen of Israel is murdered. Every day. Sometimes more than one a day. And then you say, okay, it's inherent. It's a societal thing. It's a cultural thing.
That's how they are.
That's how they are, Arabs. Well, they don't do it in Jordan. And they don't do it in the West Bank. Not even in Gaza, they don't do it. The only Arab population that civilly, like in the civil sense, not in wars, killed themselves in a criminal manner, is in Israel. Why is that? Discrimination in education, discrimination in welfare, discrimination in mobilization possibilities, discrimination in the economical market, in how to purchase housing. So if you don't have access to resources and you don't have job opportunities and you get and you don't have good education, where do you go to? You go to criminal organized crime. Organized crime gives you that mobilization. It gives you this sense of belonging. It gives you resources. Where does the guns come from? Why are there so many guns in our cities? Netanya is a Jewish city, right? They were festered in organized crime years ago, to the point that people blew up all the time in the streets because of criminal activity. It was a national campaign against it, top to bottom from the state. It was dealt with. Why wasn't it cultural for Jews? When Jews killed each other criminally, it wasn't cultural. It was systemic. It was a systemic flaw. And we fixed it. And now in Netanya, people are not blowing up. The same thing could happen in Arab society as well. It needs the will to do it. But when you have Ben Gvir as a minister of internal security, so it can't happen because he gains from it. And it's the same. So you see the drift from Jewish supremacy against Palestinians cross-border in the West Bank to Jewish supremacy internally in Israel proper, that we want, the government wants to make their lives unbearable so that they will leave, so that they will die. And that's the outcome.
Hier ist Tyler, hier kommt die Werbung. Für uns selbst. Kommerzfreier Journalismus seit 2013, nur möglich durch deine Unterstützung. Schau in die Infos wie.
Final question. there are more than 20% of Israeli citizens or citizens of Israel are of Palestinian heritage. Most of these Palestinian Israelis, they don't even vote. Like when there's an election, they don't go. But I can imagine you guys need those people, those voters as well. How do you make them go to the election this time?
Well, we did internal polls before our announcement of running, and we saw that 75% of young Palestinian citizens don't vote.
75%.
And 60% of women don't vote. And we asked them, if there would be a new party like ours, will you vote? And we saw positive reactions to that. And that is was part of our motivation to declare our running. We think that it's also very important politically, but also in terms of a societal participation in the day-to-day life and the ability to change our reality is to give these people a voice. And that's, we are very much aiming to that crowd.
How many votes do you guys need? How much, how many votes do you need to get into the Knesset as a member?
It depends on how many people vote, because then you cut away from that, but you need 3.25% of the general voters to vote for you, and that is considered four seats.
Are you guys hopeful? Like, if you guys get 3.25%, you would be in the Knesset?
Yes. We are very hopeful, we are very confident, and but we are also we are also responsible. Losing, if we get only 3% of the vote and not go in, those 3% go to the garbage. They are burnt votes. And that is a catastrophe, because we need as much seats as we can to take down this current government. We feel that we are a part of that effort and that we are a part of change, and we have the confidence that we can do it and that it is needed. But if we see that there is no certainty in that, then we won't run till the end.
Well, good luck. This is going to be probably the most busy or the busiest 3 months in your life.
It already is, yes.
Well, I hope you guys made it it to the Knesset.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yonatan. Thanks for having us.
Tell all the Israelis who live in Berlin to come on voting day here and vote for us.
Can't they vote in Berlin?
No.
Like go to the Israeli embassy or something?
No.
No, really?
No. 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 In Israel, you have to be you have to vote physically.
That's unfair. Like I know many, you know, migrants in Germany, they just go to the Turkish embassy.
I know. I know. It's not fair, because there is a there is an effort to diminish the political competition. So
is it because, like, oh, those Israelis living abroad, they're mostly left-leaning, so we don't want the votes or something?
Well, it's been like that forever. Okay. So it stems from all sorts of reasons. But I think that in modern times, it should have changed already.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons it doesn't change, I think, is because expats usually will vote against the current government.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you guys listen, fly to Israel.
Come and vote.
Sometime in October, right? You guys don't know when the election is, right?
All right. It's either going to be the 20th of October or the 27th. That's currently what is expected.
Jonathan, thank you so much. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.